The International Court of Justice orders Israel to allow unhindered aid into Gaza.
The World Court judges said in their order, quote, "The court observes that Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but that famine is setting in."
Hopes for a resumption of ceasefire talks as Israel vehemently rejects a report commissioned by the UN Human Rights Body that concludes genocide is occurring in Gaza.
In this darkest hour, the international community cannot continue to ignore that it's Israel's project to rid Palestine of Palestinians in defiance of international law and the world's failure to call Israel to account.
And a look at what may be behind the Kremlin's continued claims that Ukraine and the West had a hand in last week's horrific attack on a Moscow concert hall. Today is Saturday, March 30th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. The International Court of Justice Thursday issued a legally binding order for Israel to take measures without delay to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Diane Tu with Reuters explains exactly what this means.
The World Court on Thursday ordered Israel to end spreading famine in Gaza, demanding it take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies to the Palestinians there. The unanimous ruling from the International Court of Justice came as aid agencies say only about a fifth of needed supplies are entering the war-shattered enclave. The World Court judges said in their order, quote, "The court observes that Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but that famine is setting in." The judges said this could be done by, quote, "increasing the capacity and number of land crossing points and maintaining them open for as long as necessary." The court ordered Israel to submit a report in a month to detail how it had given effect to the ruling. The new measures were requested by South Africa as part of its case that accuses Israel of state-led genocide in Gaza. A senior Hamas official said the ruling did not go far enough and Israel must be ordered to end its military offensive to halt the suffering, saying, quote, "We welcome any new demands to end this humanitarian tragedy in Gaza and especially in the northern Gaza Strip, but we hope the court would order a ceasefire as an absolute solution to all the miseries our people in Gaza are living through." The UN Security Council voted on Tuesday to demand an immediate ceasefire and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages. In a change from its previous stance, the United States abstained from but did not veto the vote. Israel has said it is making efforts to expand access for humanitarian groups to Gaza over land, through airdrops and by ship. But aid agencies say it's not nearly enough.
Diane Tu with Reuters reporting. Earlier this week, an independent expert's mandated report on the situation in Gaza presented her published findings to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese.
I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent: causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group.
She urged member states to impose an arms embargo and sanctions on Israel.
The genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the native Palestinians. For over 76 years, this process has oppressed the Palestinians as a people in every way imaginable, crushing their inalienable right to self-determination demographically, economically, territorially, culturally, and politically. Israel has attempted to displace them, expropriate their land and other resources, and ultimately replace them.
Israel said it utterly rejects the report and accused Albanese of working to delegitimize the very creation and existence of the State of Israel. Joining us for a deeper look at the implications of the report is Israeli-born historian Omer Bar-Tov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University.
This is not an easy thing to call out. What is your reaction to the actions that have taken place this week, and do you see this as reasonable?
Well, yes. You know, first of all, the ICJ already in its initial a list of provisional measures called on Israel to increase its humanitarian aid. Israel seems to have reported back. I don't know that we've seen what it reported back to the ICJ, but facts on the ground, including American reports, appear to show that exactly the opposite has happened. So there's less Israeli humanitarian aid. And in fact, apparently hundreds of thousands of trucks that are unable to get into Gaza, and we've reached the bizarre situation where the United States, on the one hand, is supplying Israel with arms and munitions to facilitate its attacks, and at the same time is parachuting supplies into Gaza and trying to bring them in by sea, and Israel simply not cooperating in that. And then we have reports of growing hunger and signs of famine in Gaza as a whole, and especially in the northern part, where there are about apparently 200,000 civilians or so who are getting almost no supplies because Israel has blocked all supplies from the north and they are unable to get them safely from the south. And so if you ask whether this makes the grounds for plausibility of genocide firmer, yes, it does. And clearly also, when an occupying army is occupying a particular territory, it's responsible for the welfare of the population it's occupying. And if it is not taking care of it or harming it, then it's clearly involved in war crimes, and in this case, in crimes against humanity. And I think the evidence for this is as clear as it can be.
In her comments, she described the violence, saying it was the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the Palestinians. Would you say that does genocide mean it's intentional?
Well, I mean, the two parts to the statement. First of all, for genocide, for something to be proven as genocide, you have to show intent, and you have to show that the intent is being implemented and that the intent is to destroy a particular group as such. So you have to link those elements together. It isn't enough to show, for instance, that the Israeli military policies on the ground are causing famine. That's a war crime, for sure. But is it intentional? It appears to be, but one would have to prove it. My own sense is that what Israel is trying to do is to empty the Gaza Strip of its population. That, and there have been many statements along these lines. So that's forcible removal, which we usually refer to as ethnic cleansing, although that is not defined in international law. The second term that she uses is settler colonialism. That's a kind of, I don't see it necessary to speak about this. This is a more complicated issue, whether Zionism is simply settler colonialism or not. But what it certainly functionally is doing here, or what the state of Israel is functionally doing, or appears to be doing, is trying to empty the Gaza Strip with the intent later on, as extreme members of the cabinet have said, to settle it. And thereby, one could argue that it's an attempt to destroy that part of the Palestinian population that lives in Gaza as such, which could come to genocide.
The court actually gave the apparently legally binding orders to Israel. How does that get enforced? And it said Israel needed to report back. How does that work? Because we've heard the calls, risk of famine now, famine setting in, and over 32,000 people dead. Doesn't seem like there's any ability to have influence over what Israel wants to do.
Correct. So the ICJ, like any court, but that's an international court, cannot enforce its rulings on its own. That has to go to the Security Council. And then the Security Council has to make a decision on that. And then the Security Council, if nobody vetoes its decision, which until recently was the United States, can then act by, say, issuing sanctions. So it is the Security Council is the enforcement agency for the ICJ. Now, whether it would do it or not, you know, the ICJ passed provisional measures also against Russia, and nothing happened because the Security Council that Russia is a member of obviously cannot act. In this case, the U.S. has been the backer of Israel. Most recently, as you know, the U.S. abstained. And there is clearly a growing rift, and a deeper rift, between the Netanyahu government and the U.S. administration, and the next steps that the U.S. can take both in the area of not giving it cover in the Security Council, so that even more robust decisions would be made by the Security Council. And second, and most immediately and importantly, is to reduce the supply of munitions to Israel. And Israel is playing a game here whereby it's sort of both thumbing its nose at the United States and asking for more and more weapons. And the simplest thing, technically, for the United States is to say, well, you want to continue this war to go to Rafah or whatever, you can do it, but we are not going to supply with anything. And then the IDF would not be able to operate for more than a couple of weeks. It will simply run out of munitions. Those are being supplied regularly by the U.S. There are domestic policy constraints, at least the administration seems to think it has those constraints, but I think it's being put in a corner. And that is eventually probably what is going to slow down the operation, which is in any case not about to happen. The IDF is not prepared to continue the operation right now without calling up massive reserves, which there's a lot of reluctance to do. And it doesn't have the munitions to carry it out. So a lot of this is also just empty threats right now. But meanwhile, the population, of course, is in absolutely dire straits, and this famine will spread very quickly now that supplies are still not getting in.
We've heard this word genocide, and we've heard, you know, all that we've discussed here. What does it take to make a final determination about genocide, and has the UN actually declared that, or is it one of those things where you're very careful not to make a final determination as to whether it is a genocide? Or is that very close, or are they actually basically saying that?
Well, look, I mean, people, including UN officials in various agencies, can say all kinds of things. But the determination will be made by the International Court of Justice, by the ICJ. The ICJ ruled on plausibility of genocide and passed these provisional measures. It will ultimately decide, but it won't decide in the coming weeks. This will take months and possibly years because they have to look through a huge amount of documentation, not all of which exists. So by the time they decide on whether it is or it was genocide, events may change. So what I think is important is that we are operating under the suspicion that what may be happening is genocide. But I must add that even if we don't know whether eventually this will be ruled as genocide or not, what we are seeing right now are severe breaches of humanitarian law, of international humanitarian law, of war crimes, of starvation, of indiscriminate killing of civilians. All of those don't necessitate showing that it's genocide. They're crimes, though, and they have to be stopped.
Israel's denying that it is committing genocide and basically says the South Africa is trying to undermine its inherent right and obligation to defend its citizens.
Well, yes, but that's nonsense. The case that South Africa presented was very well documented. The defense by Israel was not strong and consequently was also not accepted by the ICJ. Israel has made all kinds of accusations of this being blood libel, meaning that it's that South Africa was motivated by anti-Semitism. That is just pure, empty rhetoric. There are good grounds to investigate this. But as I say, when we constantly talk about is this genocide or not, are we thereby also letting Israel go on its policies while we are debating this? We should not be doing this. We should be saying what is happening now has to be stopped. Then we can give it names. We can later determine what sort of crimes were committed. But right now, we know that tens of thousands of people have been killed and tens of thousands more may die either from military action or simply from lack of resources of the most essential needs.
Well, what about the U.S.? If the U.S. is contributing to that, should the U.S. be also held accountable?
First of all, the U.S. has become complicit in this. Whatever its intentions were at the beginning, months ago, when the Israeli campaign began and the U.S. said, well, we have to let them get rid of Hamas, by now, the U.S. is complicit in what is happening in Gaza by giving political cover and providing the military means for it. So, first of all, It has to radically change course for its own good, for its own national interests, and to my mind, quite apart from the humanitarian reasons, also for the interest, the national interests of Israel, which is heading down a very dangerous path, also to greatly deteriorate the security situation and political situation in the entire region, which will completely veer out of control. Now, should the U.S. also be held responsible? Yes, it should, but you know how it is. International relations are relations between states, and when states are very big and powerful, it's much more difficult to hold them to account. So what, to my mind, is most important right now is for the U.S. to do the right thing and to get much more control over the Israeli government, the result of which will be the fall of the Netanyahu coalition, because Netanyahu has a great interest in continuing the war. If the war ends, even if there is a sustained peace fire, that threatens his rule. His coalition will fall. If there's an election in Israel, he has very little chance of being reelected. And that will bring about a change in the entire political paradigm, which is crucial for American interests, but also for Israeli interests and hopefully for the Palestinians as well.
Thank you so much for your insights. We really appreciate it.
Sure, you're most welcome.
Omer Bar-Tov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. With the war now in its sixth month, recent efforts by the United States, Qatar, and Egypt to negotiate a ceasefire agreement have stalled. But there was a semblance of hope on Good Friday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will return to the table for talks with Hamas. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the story.
Friday's announcement marks yet another attempt to reach a deal with the militant group that would pause Israel's military offensive in Gaza in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages. Several rounds of negotiations have faltered, though. Netanyahu says he has spoken with Israel's lead negotiators and authorized Israeli delegations to join talks in Gaza and Egypt over the coming days. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Russia launched another large-scale attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure with a mass barrage of drones and missiles hitting regions across the country. The attacks come as Russia continues to reel from last week's deadly terror attack at a packed Moscow concert hall. While the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the massacre, Russia continues to blame Ukraine and the West. On Thursday, White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby described the allegation as nonsense.
It's abundantly clear that ISIS was solely responsible for the horrific terrorist attack in Moscow last week. In fact, the United States tried to help prevent this terrorist attack. And the Kremlin knows this. In advance of the March 22nd attack, the United States government provided clear, detailed information to Russian authorities regarding the terrorist threat against large gatherings and concerts in Moscow. On March the 7th, at 11:15 in the morning, Moscow time, following normal procedures and through established channels that have been employed many times previously, the United States government passed a warning in writing to Russian security services.
Almost immediately after the concert hall attack, Russia seemed to be planting the seed by saying the suspects fled toward the Ukrainian border. For a deeper look into what may be behind the Kremlin's continued unsupported narrative, I'm joined by Nicole Wolkov, Russia analyst with the Institute for the Study of War.
Why do you see Russia continuing this narrative without producing any sort of evidence?
This is definitely a clear effort from the Kremlin, and there could be a couple reasons why this is happening. First, this supports the ongoing conditioning for the Russian population to make sacrifices to continue the war in Ukraine and to continue to support the war in Ukraine. Also, this could bolster any Russian societal support for any sort of future impactful event, such as a potential another wave of mobilization. So this could help set favorable conditions in the event that another mobilization were to happen. And then this also could support a future Russian effort to threaten escalation against Ukraine to target Western decision makers to preempt concessions on supporting Ukraine.
State-run media in Russia has been avidly playing up to the idea that Ukraine and the West were behind the attack. Obviously, as you're saying, it sounds like this effort is intentional to support Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin's domestic agenda and continue justifying Russia's war on Ukraine. Does it matter what Russian citizens think if they've already been suppressed? Why does the government try so hard to make sure they're on board with whatever current or future plans Russia may have, whether it's in Ukraine or beyond Ukraine?
We're consistently seeing Putin want to maintain support for the war among the population in order to reduce political consequences against him and other Russian government efforts, that more efforts to support the war, such as another wave of mobilization or more economic efforts towards the war, would create among the Russian population.
Does it also, in some respects, have sort of an effort to save face that it had a serious intelligence failure, missing this sort of a threat? Could be hard to explain if they agreed to the fact that the Islamic State was actually behind it, in light of the fact that earlier in March, the U.S. warned Russia of intelligence indicating extremists had imminent plans for an attack?
Yes, that definitely could be part of it. We have seen that Russian officials are attempting to show that they can directly respond to public calls for retribution after the attack. And so linking this to Ukraine is also another way for Russian officials to show that they are actively responding to public calls for the Russian government to act, and that it can act.
They put on a very tough persona. And if they were to concede that they missed this, it would just be unheard of to even concede that at this point, I guess. Do you see it that way?
I think that conceding that Russian officials would have a more difficult time to come up with actionable solutions. Whereas linking this attack to the war in Ukraine allows them to forward several narratives that they have consistently wanted to forward since the start of the war, as well as appear that they are doing things to directly respond.
So basically, by having a public that is so traumatized by this horrific event, is it basically this is a way for the Kremlin to sort of justify potentially further escalation in its war efforts in Ukraine?
Yeah, and to possibly justify any sort of future large-scale event in Ukraine, or potential another wave of mobilization.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nicole Wolkov, Russia analyst with the Institute for the Study of War. And finally, the South Lawn of the White House next week will be blanketed with kids as plans are underway to continue a wildly popular annual tradition. We hear about it from Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani.
The White House is expecting a big crowd at an annual Easter celebration next week. Some 40,000 people are anticipated to be on the South Lawn for the Easter egg roll, 10,000 more than last year, as the White House continues an old tradition.
It began a long time ago, 1878.
The first president who did so was a guy named Rutherford B. Hayes.
Presidents since have followed.
I want to welcome you to the White House today.
Welcome to your house.
Happy Easter!
There's the actual rolling of the eggs.
On your mark,
get set.
This year, Jill Biden's continuing her educational theme, what she calls eggucation, with various stations helping kids learn about farming, healthier eating, exercise, and more. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.